You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
Greg and Doug Stokes with Stokes Family Office's Lanyap podcast. Today is Thursday, June 8th, 2023. An exciting week in the markets, which we'll go into in a second, but even more exciting week for a sports fan. Something seemingly unconceivable happened earlier this week when LIV Golf purchased or merged with the PGA Tour. So something that that the PGA Tour had been basically lambasting all of their players that left to play in this other league, LIV Golf. They did the exact same thing on a league level where they merged with the Saudi-backed fund. And secondarily, in amazing news, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, Lionel Messi, the star of the World Cup from this past year on Argentina's team, left European soccer and is going to play in American Soccer League, the MLS. So it's going to be amazing. I'm really excited about that. It's really truly unprecedented. We've had a couple of stars historically that have come to play in the MLS, but they're way past their prime. And Lionel Messi just won the World Cup this past year. So tectonic shifts.
I would say he's sort of past his prime. But
I would say he's past his, well, he's 30, 35. But he was like, when David Beckham, I was just reading this, David Beckham came to play here in 2007. Yeah. And he didn't even make the English World Cup team in 2006.
Yeah, they had Thierry Henry. Basically, there was a period of time in which MLS was where sort of the European great soccer players came to retire. That's probably the case too with Messi, but Messi's just on a whole nother level. I mean, he's the greatest,
arguably.
Yeah, he's the greatest player of all time, and just won the World Cup. I mean, he's not like at the end of his career. It's sort of the twilight, but still.
So he's awesome. Won the Ballon d'Or, which is like the best player in the world soccer trophy. And he's won that 7 times, which is one of the, I think it's the most times anybody's won it. He also has the most goals in Champions League history. To your point that he's past his prime, the last time he won the Ballon d'Or was 2 or 3 years ago. So there are some awesome younger guys. Like the best player right now is this Norwegian guy that plays for Man City. I'm not going to even attempt to pronounce his name, but for the fact that
Mbappe
is one of the best players as well too.
Yeah, he's amazing. I don't know anything about soccer. I watched a little bit.
But anyway, I've been following him more and more as time goes on. It's really a lot of I don't have that much of an attention span for sports, and baseball, even with the pitch clock, is just a little too slow for me. Football, college football and pro football just take 4 or 5 hours a game. Soccer takes 45 minutes each half, and there's only a 15-minute intermission. So it's a lot of action. It's over with quickly. So I've been following a lot more. And the most recent World Cup was amazing. I watched several games, especially the last game was one of the best games I'd ever seen in any sort of sporting event. And the fact that we have the World Cup champion team coming to play in the United States. It's really, it's already garnering all kinds of attention. Another interesting stat about Messi. So I just did some research in lieu of this or in anticipation of this podcast. Messi's jersey. So the total revenue of the team that Messi played for last year, Paris Saint-Germain, was $135 million, and the amount of money that they made in jerseys for that team, Messi jerseys for that team, surpassed their team revenue. And then secondarily, Inter Miami, right now the cheapest ticket, that all the tickets that Inter Miami's playing in, the team that Messi's going to play for this upcoming soccer season, are sold out. And the secondary market, the cheapest ticket that you can buy to see him play anywhere in any city, is $800 as it stands right now. So it's just really sort of incredible.
It's our recession indicator, basically.
Right. This is like the Taylor Swift recession indicator type thing. So it really is amazing, and I'm really excited to watch how he plays and see how the American populace is going to respond to having such the best player ever to play, not in his prime like you correctly noted, but still very deadly as a player. It's going to be interesting to see how he dominates.
Well, I think the most interesting thing is that he passed up a 3-year, $1.6 billion offer from some team in Saudi Arabia. And I think it really stems from his wife not wanting to live in Saudi. And so...
happy wife, happy life, right?
Yeah. I'm sure he's a billionaire at this point. So... And he may make $1 billion off this deal with Inter Miami because I think he's getting a share of Apple TV's streaming revenues for MLS.
And he's getting a share of the revenue from Adidas as well, too.
Yeah.
Like any Adidas revenue increase as a result of MLS this year, he's getting a piece of. It's pretty crazy they were just able to structure this deal with all these disinterested parties. Yeah. To bring him in town. But then on this happened. I'm super excited about just as a soccer fan and to see this level of a player, the best player. It's like Michael Jordan coming to play in your country or whatever. On the other side of the equation, I was completely shocked, and you're more of a golf fan than I am. So tell me how you feel about this whole LIV and PGA Tour thing.
It's not really clear how it's going to play out. And so I don't really know what the dynamics are going to be after the merger takes place and if there's going to be some sort of like attempt to block this merger and players go off and do their own thing. But at the surface, it's just a complete, a case of hypocrisy, I think, is the biggest takeaway from this. So the background here is that PGA Tour was they had players that were being picked off by LIV Golf, which is backed by the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Saudi Arabia, starting as far as 2 years ago, and really a little over a year ago became more in the public view to the point where the commissioner of the PGA Tour, a guy named Jay Monahan, came out and basically said that if PGA Tour players defect and go play for LIV Golf, they're essentially, siding with Saudi Arabian government, which was theoretically a sponsor of 9/11 and terrorist attacks in New York City and Pentagon, and so that was like sort of the line drawn in the sand that players were defecting. And taking such bad press, but taking a lot of money to do it, and essentially saying that they're going over to LIV Golf because the Saudi government is trying to whitewash their sort of historical terrorist activities, and so 12 months later, it sounds like there's a suit and it sounds like a couple things were going to happen. Number one. They were in talks with John Rahm, who's the number one player in the world right now, to defect and go to LIV Golf. And then number two, as part of the discovery for these lawsuits, it sounds like a lot of information was going to come out from the PGA Tour. And I don't think the commissioner of the tour wanted that information to come out. And so those two things, that there was some momentum picking up, that players were defecting, and number two, that there's going to be some information that was leaked via discovery sort of forced PGA's hand. And so the backlash here is that there are players like Tiger Woods was offered $800 million to go play for the PGA for LIV and leave the PGA Tour. And he decided not to do it. And all of a sudden, 12 months later, he doesn't have that $800 million. And now LIV and PGA Tour are merging. At least that's the thoughts now. So, If I'm a professional golfer and I was true to the PGA Tour and I stood my ground and I had a several hundred million dollar check in front of me, I'm probably pretty pissed off right now.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine. And then likewise, the people that were lambasted, like Phil Mickelson, for example, for joining LIV are vindicated and they have money in their pocket because they'd be in the exact same position in any event either way.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Well, so we talked about recession indicator, meaning like, okay, the Taylor Swift tickets are, through the roof. Lionel Messi, if you want to go see him, you got to fork over $800 to sit in the nosebleeds, no matter where you are in the city or where you are in the country. So these are not really things that you see during recessionary times. So people are just being pretty loose with their money. And that's also happening on the – we so far have not really seen any sort of major recessionary signals, even though the housing market seems to be the, you know, the one area that is showing signs of slowing down. But there hasn't been any significant recessionary indicators other than that particular item so far. And, of course, things can happen quickly. And we'll talk about how quickly markets move in a second, which is we've seen today in the oil markets. But – just specifically, and I wanted to refer to this. So Goldman Sachs basically confirms what we're saying here. And this is as of their most recent quarterly report. We have cut our judgment probability that the U.S. economy will enter recession in the next 12 months back to 25%, undoing our upward revision to 35% shortly after the SVB failure, Silicon Valley Bank failure. Also, heavy trucks. This is another just anecdotal item. Heavy trucks continue to increase. Before the past seven recessions, we saw this decline as well before the recession started. So we were seeing a lot of corporate investment and items that you would need in an expansionary time. And likewise, earnings per share thus far have been really more consistent with 2015, 2016 versus the early 2000s or the global financial crisis. So I want to just get, I threw a lot of items at you there, Doug, just related to overall sort of recessionary environments. The stage was really set for a recession by the Fed raising rates, which we talked about to a significant degree. And you would think that because rates were at 0% about a year and a few months ago, and now they're at 5.25%, you would think that there might be a recession as a result of that. The Fed just slowing the economy down like that, but it just hasn't been borne out in the data, and certainly not as it relates to these sort of anecdotal things that we see, and then what I just referenced here. So I want to get your thoughts on unpacking all of that that I just went through.
It reminded me of, and we were talking about this on the podcast at the time. But this was probably like August, September of last year, maybe even earlier than that, when we had two consecutive months of negative GDP growth. And then there was sort of that political debate as to whether it was technically a recession last year or not. And I think we sided on, came to the agreement that technically two negative quarters of GDP decline in that instance didn't really signify a recession. But then it reminded me of a survey that went out to Fortune 500 CEOs. And this was a result. This was from October of 2022. It's the conference board measure of CEO confidence. Say that five times fast. It says the recent survey asked. This is October 22nd, 2022. The recent survey asked CEOs to describe the economic conditions they are preparing to face over the next 12 to 18 months. An overwhelming majority, 98%, say they're preparing for a U.S. recession. And so. It's just funny how quickly things change. At least the market is acting like that either it's going to be a soft landing or a recession's avoided altogether. I like to read Scott Granis, who writes the blog Calafia Beach Pundit. He says, last week, the Fed effectively announced there would be no rate hike at the June 14th FOMC meeting, but there might be a hike at the July 26th meeting. I think the information we have to date strongly suggests the Fed is done. No more hikes. The only question now is when they start cutting and how much. Currently, the bond market is priced to a 50% chance of a 25% hike in late July meeting and at least a 1% cut by year end. With the peak funds coming in late summer, I think there's a decent chance we'll see short-term rates end up lower. And then he says that basically that he believes that we're going to be avoiding a recession. I'm optimistic the economy will avoid a recession because I see low and falling swap and credit spreads, which in turn are indicative of a healthy outlook for the economy and corporate profits. So it's funny, 9 months after 98% of CEOs were preparing for a recession, the strong likelihood, at least in the data, is that a recession will be avoided. Of course, that remains to be seen, but it's pretty amazing. I think the other thing I find interesting is just how the market has moved. And this is the CNN Fear and Greed Index as of yesterday. And we went from extreme fear two and a half months ago, middle of March, when banks were failing, to now in the extreme greed side of the band. And so technically, if you look at that from the perspective of being not following the herd, you would expect that we're probably due for some sort of correction, just to get things back in line. But it's crazy how quickly sentiment changes.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is crazy. I mean, there's all kinds of things that would have, like, if you're just looking at it objectively, like these are just bad signs. Like the Silicon Valley Bank failure, like you just mentioned, everything else that took place last year. I mean, there's bad news that happens all the time. Sometimes good news is bad news. I mean, if you're rooting for the Fed to stop raising rates, you want to root for some bad economic data, which shows them that inflation might be cooling down or employment might be going up. But you're right. So right now you are seeing a lot of greed, and the market's positive on a day-to-day basis. So that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while. But then eventually, the same sort of people that they're rushing into the market are probably going to be the first ones to come out. And that's just part of the normal building blocks of a bull market. You have these sort of the weak hands will come in late and then also leave early. But hopefully, over the long time, the stock market functions like it has, which is functions as a weighing machine over the long term, instead of a voting machine over the short term, like Ben Graham famously said.
Yeah, going on top of that, this is about weak hands. I think that this is a really good reminder. This is from Jeffrey Kleintop, who's the global chief strategist at Schwab. He says, here's a reminder that bull markets don't wait for recessions to be over or even to start, in this case for Europe. And so the news from today is that Europe had its second quarter of negative GDP growth. So technically, recessionary times in Europe. But since the end of the last quarter of positive GDP growth, so fourth quarter of 2020, the start of the fourth quarter of 2022, the MSCI Europe Equal Weighted Index, so just the European stock market, total return since 10/31/2022 is up almost 23%. And so, people we hear this, I think we say this all the time on the podcast, is because we hear it all the time from people. It's, I'm going to wait for the dust to settle before I get back in. The market is a forward-looking mechanism and discounts expectations into the future. And when those expectations change, when a recession is not as bad as first thought, then things get re-rated pretty quickly. And if you're waiting for the dust to settle, the returns have already been basically squeezed out at that point.
Yeah, people like to buy high and sell low, just as the nature of human beings work. And so the idea of waiting for things to normalize, they're waiting to buy high, and then eventually when they buy high, when things eventually inevitably fall off, they're going to want to sell as well too. So the idea is to try to separate yourself from your inner human and that psychology that exists. The hardest thing about being an investor is to run into a burning building, basically. But that's a lot of times what you have to do to make money.
Yeah, I mean, and just have a diversified portfolio. And the good thing now is that you actually can get paid on your sort of your stable, quote unquote, stable investments. So if you have a high quality fixed income or T-bills or something like that, you can sit on the sideline with a portion of your portfolio that's sort of your fixed area of the portfolio and clip coupons at 5%+ now. So that's not the worst thing in the world. The hard thing was, 3 or 4 years ago, especially COVID, it's like, okay, let's wait for COVID to be over and let's go sit on the sidelines. And what are you doing on the sidelines? You're earning 0% rate of return in cash and bonds. And so I guess there's one bright side that if you do want to be a little bit dynamic with your portfolio, and let's say you have a 60-40 portfolio and you want to go 50-50 because of whatever, at least you're earning something on the 50% that's in bonds.
Agreed. For those people that have been owning bonds for the last 3 or 4 years, this is an interesting chart that Charlie Bolello put out, that we're in the longest drawdown in the U.S. bond market in history as it stands right now. The as it's from, since August of 2020, the drawdown in the bond market has been 34 months. The closest, the worst other time frame was in from October of 80 to 81, 16 months. And the max drawdown over this period was 17%. There's been a lot of pain basically to get to the point at which your bond portfolio has been paying 4 or 5%. The 10-year treasury right now is like 3.7%. But you're right, now you can earn a significant amount on your bonds. And so prospective returns should be a lot better than they were back when returns are basically nothing. So that is a bright way to look at things, glass half full. And as it relates to what's happened year to date in the markets, we talked about this in the most previous podcast. The NASDAQ and specifically the top stocks in the U.S. stock market have outperformed the equal weighted markets by more than they have in history, essentially year to date. This is the S&P 500's performance versus the equal weight counterpart year to date. Right now, the S&P 500, if you just were to, the S&P 500 is balanced on a cap weighted basis. So for example, Apple is a $3 trillion company. Microsoft is a $3 trillion company, et cetera, et cetera. And those companies have a higher weighting in the index. So if they go up, then it moves the market a lot versus like your, for example, your Valvoline or something like that. If they're even in the S&P 500, it's a $20 billion company. And so if the big companies move, then that drives the market. And that's what's happened thus far year to date. But if you take that, those cap weighted companies and instead looked at every constituent in the S&P 500 as an individual component, that's the equal weighted S&P 500. And the cap-weighted S&P 500 has outperformed that equal-weighted, meaning there's just a few stocks that are driving the market on the biggest difference in history year-to-date. So far, it's about 12.5%, basically, in terms of what the biggest companies are doing. There's been some rotation back. This week has been pretty good for small-cap and value companies, but it really is interesting to what's happened thus far.
Yeah, Amazon's up, I think, 50% this year now, which is just amazing. I think last year was down 50%. So it's a game of cycles, and that's why it's important to have a diversified portfolio, own high quality companies, and just sit on them. And
you keep saying that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's the mantra.
That is the mantra: diversification, quality. And then just wait. That's the hardest thing to do.
Right, exactly. And then trying to prognosticate what's going to happen is truly impossible. Like, for example, I referenced this at the beginning of the podcast, but the oil markets, if you try to anticipate what's going to happen, like over the weekend, the Saudi government said that they agreed with their counterparts in OPEC that they're going to reduce output by a billion barrels a month or something like that.
A million.
And then, today, so the oil markets sort of recovered, and then there was a rumor leaked that was subsequently proved false that the U.S. and Iran were getting close to making an agreement to reduce their sanctions, and the oil markets fell off because that would be a ton of supply coming onto the market. And then the White House basically came out and refuted that rumor. So the oil markets went back to where they were. So trying to prognosticate what's going to happen is totally a fool's errand. Sometimes there's rumors that drive the market. Like I just mentioned, the oil markets have been bouncing all over the place. And sometimes good news is bad news. If you're betting on oil, the idea of Iran, which coming to the table as a participant in the global economy, is bad news. So it's just all kinds of dynamics that affect the markets. And it's best to just have a broad diversification and a plan, because there's all different factors at play at any given point in time. And then I want to shift gears and rant in terms of wrapping this up, but trying to listen to any particular idea or strategy to make your decisions, or any individual for that matter, to make your decisions is also not really a good strategy. This is the ChatGPT portfolio. So artificial intelligence is trying to beat the S&P 500, essentially. The S&P 500 is up 4% since it started. This ChatGPT or AI-driven portfolio is up 1% over that same period of time. So trying to utilize some technology to get an edge or whatever, a lot of times you're just better off going the simplistic route. And then secondarily, I want to get your thoughts on this, Doug. But Dave Ramsey was sued for $150 million. Dave Ramsey is a famous financial commentator that preaches values, et cetera. He's sued for $150 million for selling timeshares. So
really?
Exactly. So yeah, just be careful who you take advice from. Try not to get on the cutting edge of things and try to keep things simple, broad, right. Diversification, discipline. Those are the things that we talk about all the time. And that's our mantra.
Yeah, it reminds me of that South Park episode where they get a free trip to Park City or something like that. And every time they get off of the ski lift takes them into the timeshare sales room. And all they want to do is enjoy the trip, and they're just being sold the entire time. But we'll post
that. Speaking of that, I saw that the founders of South Park, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, bought and renovated the Casa Bonita in Denver. Yeah, there's an episode of South Park from the this is like 20 years ago. I think they still make it, which is crazy to me. But these guys are, Trey Parker and Matt Stone are, they might be billionaires. They're close to it, but they started South Park but they made all of their money with the Broadway play Book of Mormon. They've made hundreds of millions of dollars on that. Those Broadway plays, when you get them right, they're just print money basically. And they had this sort of corny episode of South Park way back in the day where they had a theme park in Denver that they must have gone to when they were kids.
Theme restaurant.
And they portrayed it. Theme restaurant. Yeah. And then the owners of it just redid it. So that'll be a fun experience next time we're in Denver, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. Appreciate you listening. And give us a 5-star review and share with your friends. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.